This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Jose Torres, the former boxing champion and writer, died Monday of a heart attack at his home in Ponce, Puerto Rico. He was 72. Torres took up boxing in the Army to get out of KP duty and went on to become an Olympic medalist and light world heavyweight champion, a title he successfully defended three times before losing in 1966. After he left professional fighting, Torres worked as an aide to several New York politicians and chaired the New York State Athletic Commission. But he also got to know writers like Pete Hamill and managed to get a column in the New York Post. With the help of Norman Mailer, he wrote a book about Muhammad Ali called Sting Like a Bee. Terry spoke to Torres in 1989 after he'd published a biography of Mike Tyson called Fire and Fear. Both men had worked with the legendary boxing trainer and manager Cus D'Amato. Some of the exploits Tyson described in the book were so extreme that they made news at the time. He told Torres that the best punch he ever delivered was to his wife, actress Robin Givens. And he described a night when he said he had sex with 24 women. Terry asked Torres if he took the story at face value or if he had a responsibility to try and separate fact from macho exaggeration.
He told me the following day when it happened. I happened to see him the day after. He told me, and I said, yeah, I believe you. Yeah, that's right. And that's it. You know, he was a little mad that I did not believe the story. And that happened months before I began to write the book. So when I began to do the interviews for the book with the tape recorder, then I reminded him of that part. And then this time he was able to call a witness, Roddy Holloway, who confirmed his story about 24 women. And it is funny because the other day someone asked me if he had reached the climax with the 24, and I said to the guy, I don't know about that, but I'll tell you one thing. His fights, his orgasm lasts longer than his fights, I said to the guy. In any event, I believe the story. I don't know if there were 24 women, though. It could have been 10. You know, Ryan O'Neill was mad. You know, he's a good friend of mine, the actor, Ryan O'Neill.
Oh, yeah. He was in a boxing movie that you consulted for.
That's right.
Yeah.
He was mad. I said, why? He said, he broke my record. I said, how much was your record? He said, 2. So we're making fun of all that. Now, about hitting Robin, I felt that it was a responsibility of mine to expose that situation, because I am one of the many writers who have been very concerned about the abuse of women in our society. And I felt that the heavyweight champion of the world, as a symbol, you know, expressed that malady in our society. And I felt it was my obligation as a professional and objective writer to do that. And I felt that Tyson told me those stories because I felt that he wanted to get them out of his system, and also because I felt he was capable of overcoming those ills.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm interested in hearing about your life as well. I was wondering if you learned to fight before you actually got into the ring.
It's amazing. I was from a middle class family within the subculture of poverty in Puerto Rico, you know, in Ponce.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we were very, very poor, but my father used to work every single day, 10 hours a day, to support his children. And at that time, when I was about 17, I decided to go into the Army. And I went to the Army, and as soon as I was there, I knew I had made a mistake. I knew that I could not live far from my family and my mother and father. And I became very depressed. And I was dizzy, like drunk, every day. I was so depressed. And then one day I asked about what can I do to get away from KP, you know, to work in the kitchen,
mm-hmm.
and to stand guard. They told me, well, if you play any sports, you can do that. I said, yeah, I play baseball. So he said, the baseball season is over. I said, well, I play basketball. They said, the basketball season is over. So I said, what is the season now? They said, boxing. I said, I box. <You know? laughs> Yeah.
So you boxed in the Army, then you won the silver medal at the 1956 Olympics in Melbourne.
Right.
Then you moved to New York to train with Cus D'Amato, who was the same trainer who trained Mike Tyson.
That's true. I'm Floyd Patterson.
Right. Now, what makes him so special?
He was special because he was not in the game to make money. He was in the game to help young children. And also because of his unique way in teaching fighters. He felt that what made the difference at the end was not the physical mechanism, but the intelligence and the character of the person. And that alone, I mean, that was so attractive to me because for the first time, I discovered that I was a normal human being when I used to get scared stiff before each fight. He taught me that I was normal. He said, if you did not get scared, I would not want you to fight for me. I want normal human beings, because normal human beings can be taught. I said, but if a guy comes to me fearless, I feel this guy's too dumb to learn how to win and become champion of the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say in your biography of Mike Tyson that Cus D'Amato didn't think that sex and boxing were incompatible. He encouraged you to bring your wife to where you were training on weekends, which I guess was pretty unusual for the time. Are the two still considered incompatible?
Well, you know, what happened with Cus was that he knew that there was no medical explanation to justify the suspicion of many athletes who said that sex weakens the legs or weakens your arms, that makes you weak. And Cus never believed that. Cus feels that in order for any young boy to become champion of the world, he has to master the fear and master his emotions. He cannot allow any emotion to get the best of him. He felt that since boxers are young, healthy, and in tremendous condition, that the need of sex is a natural thing for them. He feels that by depriving them from sex, they would develop anxiety, and anxiety is an emotion out of control. And he said the only and best way to relieve the boxer from that uncontrolled emotion is to have sex. So he felt that sex then worked on behalf of the fighter.
Mm-hmm. After you won a few middleweight bouts, D'Amato held you back. He didn't give you any significant fights for, I think, about a year. Why was he holding you back like that?
Okay, at the time, Cus D'Amato was engaged in a big fight against the boxing establishment that was being controlled by unscrupulous men at the time, all over the country. And he began to fight them, to buck them. And he used the heavyweight champion of the world, Floyd Patterson, to do that. And he used me. In the process, I was hurt a lot, but I was aware that I was hurt. But I had an interest beyond my own personal one. I felt that Cus convinced me that we together could help boxing in general, and that every young kid coming up today and after me, they would be helped by this struggle against the boxing establishment at the time. So I suffered a lot. I became champion at age 28 instead of at age 22 or 23. You know, I was ready then. But the establishment would not give me a chance to fight in retaliation for what Cus was doing to them. And of course, in the final, at the end, Cus had destroyed the boxing establishment. They put like people in jail for that after Cus finished with them. And it was a lot of bad people at the time.
During that period when you weren't fighting, people thought that you had disappeared, maybe because you were a coward. Was that hard to take?
No, because there were only few people who thought so. The boxing community knew what was going on. They knew that Cus was in this fight and that I was backing Cus. And even though we had arguments, I there were points in which I told Cus that I was being hurt too bad, that I might never become champion. And Cus says that age doesn't make champions, that old age had not been established in boxing, all that stuff. And I thought that as a matter of principle and integrity and honesty, Cus was right.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that I had to back him up. Yeah.
My guest is Jose Torres. You're also the former head of the New York State Athletic Commission, which regulates boxing. When you were in that position, were there any trends that you saw that especially disturbed you, that you thought were having a bad effect on the sport?
Well, the only thing that I was very careful about was conflict of interest in terms of Tyson. I was too close to Tyson, and I was afraid that my emotions would get the best of me because I didn't care. I used to root for Tyson when he was fighting, but not in New York. In New York, I would be very, very, very objective, and also I would put the best officials to work because I knew they would not be influenced by my friendship with Tyson. But going to Atlantic City and Las Vegas and other places where Tyson boxed, I used to go to the dressing room. I used to give him advice, and that was not, you know, completely kosher, as they said here in New York.
Mm-hmm.
It was one thing I want to make sure, and that is that if Tyson boxed in New York, I used to wish that the fight would end by KO, because if Tyson was engaged in a close fight and he got the close fight, I would have been under incredible criticism because of my friendship. So I was always hoping for Tyson to knock the guy out,
mm-hmm.
so we didn't have to have that conflict. But it was also bureaucracy bothered me. It was fun at the beginning. At the end, it became too bureaucratic, and I quit to write the book, and I'm very happy.
Today we're listening to Terry's interview with writer and former light heavyweight boxing champ Jose Torres, who died on Monday. Torres was a friend of Norman Mailer, whom he regularly sparred with on Saturdays. When Terry interviewed Mailer in 1991, he talked about his relationship with Torres.
I've had a great friendship with Jose Torres over the years, and I've boxed with him a great deal. At one time he was the light heavyweight champion of the world. Now, of course, boxing with someone who's as good as that is relatively safe because, he can handle you with no pain, and therefore he has no particular interest in hurting you. But I did learn an awful lot about defense while boxing with him, because if he tapped me once, and then if I didn't make the proper move the next time, he tapped me a little harder. So after a while, he put a great many instinctive defensive moves into me.
Terry spoke with Jose Torres in 1989.
I know that when you started boxing professionally, you were friends with the writers Pete Hamill and Norman Mailer. Were they influential on your early writing and on what you were reading at the time?
Well, not only educated, not influential. I mean, they were the reason for me. I mean, Pete Hamill gave me every single book. I mean, Pete Hamill gave me the first book I ever had in my life. And he gave me the second book and the third book. You know, he gave me like 200 or 300 books. And I was reading all the time. I have never read a book other than a text, you know, book from in school. Never read a novel, never read anything until I met Pete. And that was when I was 20. And Pete got me to read. And then he got me to write. I mean, Pete was the person who is responsible for me to read and to write, you know. But he was the one. And then, of course, Norman Mailer came later because Pete introduced me to Norman Mailer. And Pete introduced me to Bud Schulberg. And they began to help me, you know. At one point, when I wrote another book called Sting Like a Bee, the biography of Muhammad Ali in 1971. Well, I went to Vermont to live a mile away from Norman Mailer, who I'm sure gave up $2 million just to help me with this book. You know, we exchange. I pay him by teaching him how to box. He was editing my book, you know, and we worked together for 2.5 months. And I finished my book there with him, changed the book around, and he went there for a project that he ignored. And it cost him maybe, I don't know, minimum $2 million, maybe $5 million.
Let's talk a little bit about what it's like in the ring. Is learning to take pain part of the art of boxing?
That's automatic. We don't think about pain. The punch that knocks you out, you don't feel the punch. Pain, usually, you feel it when you are hit in the body, you know, like in the stomach.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. But you train so hard that the pain is beyond recognition. You don't recognize pain. You know, you are so full of determination and will that you don't think about pain. The pain that you suffer in boxing is not physical pain, but mental pain. You know, when you are so afraid of losing, afraid of humiliation, being humiliated, you know, and more than anything else, you know, that's why in the gym nation, you don't care about getting hit. Fighters get hurt much more in gymnasiums than they do in actual fight. Because, first of all, actual fights are very few. In the gymnasium, you box every single day, you know, training.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there's no pressure of humiliation in the gym. So you don't care about getting hit. You take more chances in the gym,
mm-hmm.
in the fight, because of the public pressure. You are afraid to be humiliated. And, psychologically, it becomes very painful.
Well, you mentioned humiliation. I wonder what it feels like when you're hit hard and your opponent's fans are cheering.
And also when you... I think that fighters know before it happens when they're going to lose. I think they have a feeling, you know, that the fighters that loses their will to win in the midst of the fight. You know, that's why Muhammad Ali was such a great fighter. Muhammad Ali was one of the few who won fights, perhaps most of his fights, before he went into the ring. He used to discourage his opponent, and the opponent would go into the ring thinking that they were going to lose. And that was a magic that super great champions have, you know.
What's the worst punch you ever took?
The best punch I ever took, it had to be, you know, I was hit very hard maybe four times in my whole career, very hard. And I was never really hurt, but I was stunned those four times. And usually they happened with fighters who could not punch, you know, who were not recognized as good punchers. And subconsciously you take more chances with guys that don't punch. So I got hit by them because I took more chances. But punchers never hit me, with exception when I was coming up, of Florentino Fernandez, who knocked me down with one punch. And that was the only punch he hit me with. I was not stunned because I was, like, unconscious for about 1 to 2 seconds. You know, I don't remember going to the floor, but I remember when I hit the floor. And I turned toward my family, you know, my mother, my father was there, and my wife was there. And I looked at them just to tell them that I was okay. And then I got up, and I was beating him, and then something happened that I could not throw punches, you know. I was like a delayed reaction, eventually, you know, four rounds later, and the referee stopped the fight. But I learned a lot that time. But I think that was the best punch I have ever been hit with, because I went down.
Mm-hmm.
But it was no pain, though, and I didn't feel... I describe being stunned with getting a million ants into your body and then coming out. And I didn't feel that in that fight. I felt that three times with other fighters, but not with, you know, not the time that I got knocked down.
What was it like being knocked down, hearing the referee's count, while struggling to get back on your feet?
Well, I was not struggling because I was okay.
Okay.
But I can imagine, though, that it's... Wait a minute. Later on, that happened to me.
It did?
I forgot that part. My last fight, I was hit not with a good punch. I was hit with the bell. You know, the bell and the punch at the same time. And I went down and I got up. And the referee was counting. And I was conscious, but I had no control over my legs. And at that moment, I knew I would never fight again. And I went to the corner. And I came back in the second round. And I knocked the other guy out. And that was it. I never boxed again. But that was humiliating. That was very embarrassing. I didn't want to look at the crowd. I didn't want to look at none of my brothers who were there, my father. I was so embarrassed to be down. And I felt that no one would ever get that chance again. And that was my last fight.
What year was that?
1969.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your life. Thank you.
A pleasure.
Writer and former light heavyweight boxing champ Jose Torres speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. Torres died Monday of a heart attack. He was 72. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. During last Sunday's pre-inaugural concert at the Lincoln Memorial, one of the most stirring performances was given by one of the day's least well-known performers.
I was born by a river in a little bitty hole tent, long just like that river. I've been running ever since. It's been a long, long, long time coming, but I always believed that a change was gonna come.
That's Betty LeVette singing the Sam Cooke song, A Change Is Gonna Come, which he wrote 45 years ago, a year before his death in 1964. A Change Is Gonna Come became an anthem of the civil rights movement and captured the emotions many Americans felt this week as the country's first African-American president was inaugurated. Yesterday, by the way, would have been Sam Cooke's 78th birthday. But if you've never heard of Betty LeVette and are wondering why, there's a story behind that. After a promising start in the early 60s, when she had a couple of singles that became R&B hits, things just didn't work out for her. The 1972 album she recorded for Atlantic that was supposed to be her breakthrough wasn't released until 2000, when a French producer licensed it from Atlantic and started her comeback. Joe Henry produced an album by her in 2005. Her most recent recording is The Scene of the Crime. Like her 1972 disc, it was recorded in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Terry spoke with Betty LeVette last year. Let's start with a song from The Scene of the Crime. Written by Willie Nelson, it's called Somebody Pick Up My Pieces.
I wanna be taken out of contention. I surrender my crown. Somebody pick up my pieces. I think I'm coming down. Well, I sure thought I had it, but Lord, it looks like it had me. 'Cause the thing I thought was heaven was just falling debris. But I sure got a hell of a start. Somebody come here and pick up my pieces. I think I'm falling apart. Now don't follow my footsteps.
Betty LeVette, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, what kind of places were you singing before starting your comeback in 2005?
Well, it wasn't a lot of places. I was in Detroit, and I was working in little bitty places for $50 a night, and people were drunk or busy talking or dancing or whatever, and I was just around. But I wasn't doing any traveling much at all, just maybe, you know, the faithfuls in Europe who kept having me back there trying to keep me alive, just from a love affair that started with me in 1965 over there. But I wasn't really working a lot at all. It was more people paying house notes and car notes and whatever for me than me being able to do anything.
So people were helping you with your own bills?
Oh, absolutely.
Were you angry at your lack of recognition?
Oh, for sure. It's not so much anger but hurt, because it's, you know, it's not... It's just being completely ignored. It's not like selling full of brushes or something. It's you you're selling. So when they don't buy it, they're saying, we don't like you. So it's not my product. We don't like you. So I it was very hurtful, very, very painful, if it wasn't for the people who were propping me up.
Yeah. Now, as you mentioned before, you grew up in Detroit. When did you start singing?
My parents sold corn liquor from the time they came from Louisiana to Muskegon, Michigan, where I was born, until about maybe 1958. And there was always a jukebox in our living room as opposed to a couch and stuff there are in most people's living rooms. And so I was privy to a whole gang of songs. So I sung as soon as I could talk. My mother said I've always talked and sung like an adult. She said she used to talk baby talk to me to try to make me sound like a baby. But I pretty much always sounded like James Brown.
That's really funny. So what were the parties like when your parents sold the corn liquor and had
Well, they weren't really parties. I mean, you know, there was no gambling or prostitution or any of that. People just come and dance and drink for a while. My mother, you know, Louisiana is strictly alcohol and food. So my mother always had the food going. My father had the corn liquor going. And they would stand me sometimes on top of the jukebox, and I could sing along with the songs, blues songs.
Were they songs with meanings that you couldn't quite comprehend yet?
Oh, I didn't know anything about them at all. I mean, I was 18 months old when I first started singing. I first started talking about that point. But there were people, because it was segregation still. So if you came to a little town like Muskegon and you were black, you couldn't drop by a restaurant or a bar anytime you wanted to. So they came to my house. So I had the Five Blind Boys and the Pilgrim Travelers and the Soul Stirrers and all those people at my house.
Wow. So what were, you mentioned some of the musicians who used to come to your house to eat and drink. What was some of the other music you were exposed to early on?
Well, it was, you know, the gospel music, because they would, when they would get drunk, they would sing there at the house, the groups that came. But I don't remember, because it was more of a, it was more conservative. There weren't a lot of people who sung secular music, who sung blues music or whatever that came to my house, because there was always this drunk prayer type thing going. So we didn't have, like, you know, there were no Sarah Vaughans or those kind of people. But of course, they were on the jukebox and we listened to them. But the people who actually came to the house were chiefly gospel singers.
Now, I'd like to go back to 1962. I believe this is the year you started recording.
Mm-hmm.
And you had, I believe it was your first record that became a hit on the R&B chart. My Man, He's a Loving Man. That was like your first 45, right?
Right.
Okay. So how did you, were what, 17 when you made this?
16.
How did you get to record so young?
It was in Detroit. That wasn't a difficult thing to do. Maybe getting on the Atlantic record label right away was something phenomenal. But in Detroit, every third person either sung, produced, or wrote, or had a record company. So it wasn't difficult at all in Detroit in 1962 to record. All you had to do was show up.
Who asked you to do it?
A young man whose name was Timmy Shaw, who was a local artist, a regional artist, more or less. None of his records had ever been really big. And it wasn't a thing where he wanted me to sing. He was trying to cajole me into something else, but he said, I can make you a star, you know.
Oh.
So he introduced me to his manager and producer, Johnny Mae Matthews, who was one of the first female producers probably in the world and certainly the only black one. And she was producing him and everybody. She had everybody that Berry Gordy had at one time, but she was just such a crooked woman, she lost them all.
So you got the R&B hit. Did he get you? The guy who is using this as
an excuse? Became a national artist, so that took me out of town.
Ah, right. Okay, so you escaped his clutches.
Yes.
So let's hear it. This is like your first hit, an R&B hit from 1962, and this is Betty LeVette. That's My Man, He's a Loving Man, Betty LeVette, recorded in 1962. Betty, it sounds so low-tech. Describe what the recording session was like.
Well, it took about an hour. It cost about $100, maybe $20, and that was mostly in drinks for the musicians. The guitar player, I can't even think of LeRoy's last name right now, but he was only about, he was younger than me. And they actually snuck him out of his bedroom window to come to the recording session.
That's great.
I mean, it was just the most amazing thing in the world. It was just amazing. I was making a record. It was amazing. And then when they played it on the radio 5 days later, because you could just press it up and walk right into the radio station and say, you play this, and slip somebody $50 or $10 or whatever it was. And so when I heard it on the radio 5 days later, I just went, ran down the street screaming. I mean, nobody else in my eighth grade class had a record.
Eighth grade?
Well, I was about, I should have been about in the ninth grade, I guess, ninth or tenth grade.
So
but it wasn't. I was recording.
What changed in your life immediately after the record started getting airplay?
Nobody in my family had ever been anywhere or done anything or had anything. No one had ever had any education, any money, had never traveled, nothing. And all those people who were on that red and black label that we that I had seen so many years on the jukebox in my house and that I had danced so much after school to, I was on the road with them in like a matter of days.
Like who?
Clyde McFadder, Benny King.
The Drifters?
No, well, it was later before I worked with the Drifters. But Otis Redding. We were all, you know, because you tended to, companies tended to send a whole group of their artists around then. So all those people were on either Atlantic or one of their subsidiaries. And I guess Otis Redding and I were we were the brokest people there. He had the same little shoes and suit every night. And I had my two little gowns that I had. But everybody else, you know, I mean, Benny King had gotten big with the Drifters. Clyde McFadder had gotten big with the Drifters. Clarence Frogman Henry, who it was his very first big record, but it was bigger than mine and Otis's. And Barbara Lynn, it was her first big record, but she had been singing for a while. But I think the brokest people probably were me and Otis. And so that caused us to spend a lot of time together because we weren't the big stars.
What was he like? What was it like to know him?
He was the most wonderful person in the world. And when people say that, they're talking about the Otis Redding they know now. I don't know what he would be like now, or I don't know what he would be like as a legend. But then he was just a broke guy from Georgia who I didn't find very sophisticated and who loved me very much. But I was from Detroit, and blacks at the time felt that if they were raised, born and raised in the North, were a little bit better than blacks who were born and raised in the South. So he just chased me around a lot, and I really kind of thought of him as just maybe one of the other guys who liked me. Had I known he was going to be Otis Redding, I probably would have acted a little better.
What'd you think of his singing then?
Oh, I just thought he was one of the greatest singers I've ever heard in my life, and still do. He, all the things that I thought about him that I thought would make him a great suitor, when he was on that stage, he looked different. He was just a totally different person on the stage.
In 1972, you recorded an album that was never released until 2005. Mm-hmm. And this is a kind of famous album now. And
it's more infamous.
And more infamous, thank you. Yeah. It was supposed to be released by Atlantic Records. It was recorded in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, but it was never released. It just lay in the Atlantic vault until a French producer licensed it from Atlantic and released it in 2000. It was initially supposed to be called Child of the 70s. What were you expecting the outcome of this album to be?
Oh, I really thought I had everything, all the components that I thought would work. I had recorded it in Muscle Shoals, where all the hits were coming from. I had Wilson Pickett's producer, Brad Shapiro. It was on an Atlantic label. It had everything that was supposed to happen. And then it didn't. So all the thoughts right after that were suicidal.
What did they tell you when they didn't release it?
They said, send the tickets back. We've decided not to go forward with the project. Those were their exact words.
But
I don't even know who it was that called me.
But you'd already finished recording it, hadn't you?
It was, I had the plane tickets to go on the road to promote it.
Oh, I see. I see.
They had already done everything.
Oh, wow. I was thinking we could hear Your Turn to Cry. You want to say anything about the song or why it was chosen?
Oh, I just chose it here again because I liked it. But it was, I thought that it sounded up to that date better than anything I had ever recorded. And I was just completely confused as to why I said it. I kept comparing it to everything else that was out. And everything was just beginning to go stereo, too. So when all the new stereo albums started coming out, then it really didn't sound very good to me. And I kept trying to see myself why they wouldn't do it. And then over the years, I completely convinced myself that it wasn't good.
You were convinced that it wasn't good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's disprove that and play Your Turn to Cry. And this is from the 1972 Atlantic album that was never released until it was licensed by a French producer in 2000. And the French release is called Souvenirs. The subsequent American release of the album is called Child of the 70s.
I gave you all of my love, but you treated me like a fool. I even gave up a right for wrong, trying to get along with you. When I wanted to hold you close, you were always too tired. Well, you had some place to go.
That's Betty LeVette, recorded in 1972, and the album that this song was recorded for has been subsequently released just a few years ago under the name Child of the 70s.
See, you and your audience are going to be as confused as I am.
All of this
happened 30 and 40 years ago, so to just remember it all is just daunting.
Well, the other funny thing is that now you're being praised for the stuff that nobody wanted to even release.
Yeah.
You know, 35 years ago.
Yep.
That must be kind of confusing.
Well, it's, you know, to have all of this energy happening to you at 61 years old is, it's consuming. You know, it's taking virtually everything, every bit of energy that I have and everything that I've ever learned. But I'm glad that I have a lot of energy left and that I learned so doggone much, because it's all coming in handy now.
Well, your new CD is called The Scene of the Crime. And the crime that you're referring to in The Scene of the Crime is the fact that after recording this album, it was never released. It just sat
right
in the Atlantic vaults until 2000.
They didn't even know they had it.
They didn't know they had it.
They didn't even know they had it. Uh-huh. They thought that it had been lost in a fire.
Oh.
And Gilles Pétard came to New York and asked them, could he search for it physically? And he did.
He's the French producer who actually released it in 2000.
Yes, yes, who has been friends with me for almost 30 years. The first 15 or 20 years that we knew each other was strictly through correspondence. It was a long time before I met him. He got me a gig in Paris, and I finally got a chance to meet him.
So he actually had to physically search through the archives of Atlantic to find it?
I had a reel-to-reel copy of it. A friend at a studio here in New York stereorized my mono reel-to-reel version of it, and I let Gilles Pétard hear it. He said, I've got to find this. It's got to come out. It's just got to come out. And he did.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I want to, you know, congratulate you on the success that you're having now.
And, oh, thank you, baby.
Yeah, a long time coming, very well deserved. And
absolutely.
Thank you again, Betty LeVette, for being with us.
Thank you, Terry, for having me.
Singer Betty LeVette speaking with Terry Gross in 2007. Her most recent CD is called The Scene of the Crime. She gave a memorable performance at last Sunday's pre-inaugural concert at the Lincoln Memorial. HBO will be rebroadcasting that concert this weekend. Commentators have been all over President Obama's inaugural address. While many found it forceful and lyrical, others said it was unmemorable. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg agrees with that view, but doesn't see that as a bad thing.
A modern inaugural address is sort of like an Olympic equestrian event, where the course and maneuvers are precisely spelled out and the points are awarded purely for style and execution. Obama's speech certainly made all the required moves, a few biblical allusions, a nod to Tom Paine, a shout-out to Jerome Kern. But it really wasn't particularly memorable. If we still lived in an age when people put together collections of great speeches for pupils to memorize and declaim on national holidays, it isn't likely this one would be included. The editor would more likely go with a moving speech that Obama gave in Grant Park on the night of the election.
If there is anyone out there who still doubts that America is a place where all things are possible, who still wonders if the dream of our founders is alive in our time, who still questions the power of our democracy, tonight is your answer.
But actually, I'd count the speech's unmemorability as one of its strengths. Ceremonial speechmaking is an unnatural, anachronistic exercise, and I'm not sure whether anybody could ever again give an address as memorable as Kennedy's in 1963 or Roosevelt's in 1933. People cite Reagan's 1981 speech as the best since then, and it certainly counts as one of the clearest. But its language was unremarkable and even hokey at times. The only line people remember from it is "government isn't the solution," which worked much better in the version that Reagan had been using on the campaign trail since 1975, where he added the snapper, "government is the problem." In fact, when you reread Roosevelt and Kennedy's speeches, you realize how rhetorically remote their age was. Take the famous sentence from Kennedy's inaugural that begins, "Now the trumpet summons us again, not as a call to bear arms, though arms we need, not as a call to battle, though embattled we are, but as a call to bear the burden of a long twilight struggle," and so on for another 25 words or so. It's still a stirring line, but you can't imagine any recent president trying to get away with it. Kennedy was the last president who could comfortably dip into the stew of classical figures of speech. "Not as a call to battle, though embattled we are," that would be both chiasmus and polypteton. Rhetoricians have been botanizing this stuff for millennia, and by now there's virtually no way to put two words together that doesn't have a Greek label, preserved in aspic by generations of English department pedants. The medieval scholars called those figures of speech the rhetorical colors, from a Latin term for ornament. They flourished over the centuries when the proper role of literature and oration was the decorous ornamentation of thought, and when politicians and poets drew from the same rhetorical well. And you can still turn up moves like that if you rummage around in T.S. Eliot or Wallace Stevens. But rhetorical ornament is alien to the spirit of modern literature. It still survives in some religious traditions. It comes naturally to a Jesse Jackson or Joseph Lowry, though it sounds a bit forced coming from the energetically affable Rick Warren. For the most part, though, these figures are reserved nowadays for advertising slogans, bumper stickers, and the titles of country songs. They're the linguistic equivalent of stunt writing. Take the figure of speech in Kennedy's "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." The classical rhetoricians called that anti-metaboly, though modern speechwriters tend to refer to it as the reversible raincoat. Politicians are still irresistibly drawn to it. Bill Clinton had his "people are more impressed by the power of our example than the example of our power." John McCain had "we were elected to change Washington, and we let Washington change us." And Hillary Clinton went with "the true test is not the speeches a president delivers, it's whether the president delivers on the speeches." That figure of speech has roots in Shakespeare and Blake. It's in Kipling's "What Should They Know of England, Who Only England Know?" And Frederick Douglass used it when he said, "You have seen how a man was made a slave, you shall see how a slave was made a man." But to modern listeners, those lines are more likely to bring to mind the syntactic two-step of slogans like, "When guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns." Or in its purest classical form, "Starkist doesn't want tuna with good taste, Starkist wants tuna that tastes good." It's as catchy as ever, but it can't be the vessel for a deep idea anymore. Of course, Obama's speech was dotted with some of the other turns in classical figures that ceremonial addresses require. "A nation cannot prosper long when it favors only the prosperous." That was polypteton, or using a word in two different ways, as in FDR's "Nothing to Fear But Fear Itself." It was a tidy turn of phrase, but you had the sense Obama could have done better. And there was a soupçon of catachresis in "The Bitter Swill of Civil War and Segregation," which Obama read with a rising intonation that evoked Martin Luther King. But Obama didn't do a lot of rhetorical overreaching. he did just enough to nail the event. No, it wasn't a speech for the ages, but I found it reassuring that he kept his coat on right side out.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley.